This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
If you had told Jeff Van Duzer when he was young that he would someday go into law, represent banks, then timber companies, and then become dean of a business school, he would have said that you were smoking something. And because he grew up outside of Berkeley in the late 60s and early 70s, the heyday of the anti-establishment movement, he might even have been right. Jeff was raised in a Christian family, baptized at 12, but took his faith seriously when he went to college. He went to Yale Law School straight out of undergrad, an experience that he absolutely loved. Then worked for over 20 years in a major law firm in Seattle, eventually rising to partner status. Yet Jeff found the practice of law to be brutal. The primary goal became making more money, and the way to make more money was to work more hours. Jeff's priorities included being one with his wife, present to his two sons, faithful to Jesus, and serving his church through preaching periodically. Eventually, Jeff felt like he was constantly letting someone down, and the only solution was to move faster. Although he could keep up with his commitments and even force himself to be present with those he needed to be present with, he found himself constantly anxious and unable to quiet down even in off hours. "It was drying me up," he says. As one whose income was on the low end of the big dogs, he found himself comparing himself to others and judging them, exhibiting attitudes he abhorred. And so Jeff decided to go half-time. He was surprised that his partners granted his request. He was also surprised by how immediately changing his hours also changed his status in the firm, his sense of being an influential person. Although going half-time created a sense of luxurious space in his life, the change of influence was difficult. In those 2 years, he wrestled with God. "Look, I gave all this up for you. What are you going to do now?" Finally, a pastor friend heard a word from God for him. This was his life, and he needed to live it. It was only after Jeff came to peace with this word and settled into the life God gave him to live that a faculty friend at Seattle Pacific asked him to apply to be dean of the School of Business and Economics. Believe it or not, Jeff has never taken a business or economics class in his life. When Jeff looks back, he says he knew after 3 to 4 years in law that it wasn't the best fit for him. Yet every time he prayed about leaving law, he sensed God telling him to stay. Now he realizes that he needed all those 20 years in law to do the job that God has called him to. But coming to the university has felt like coming out of a gray closet into a green lawn. With the faculty at SPU, Jeff has been working on a theology of business, or as they call it, another way to do business. Jeff's favorite Christmas memory was playing wits and wagers with his whole family and laughing a lot, and his favorite drink is a double tall latte. Please welcome Jeff Van Duzen.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for that very kind introduction. Well, what a difference a few months make. I was asked a little while ago if I would come and share a few thoughts on how God might understand business's role in human flourishing. And I was really honored and felt incredibly privileged to be asked. I immediately said yes, and then shortly thereafter, the bottom fell out of the stock market. We lost 40 to 50% of the value in a matter of weeks. The credit dried up around the world. Unemployment rates in this nation have risen to record, or not record, but levels we haven't seen in a long time. And as you know, this economic crisis is impacting us at pretty much every level of society, the individual levels. Individuals are losing their homes, their jobs, their ability to retire, sense of hope. Businesses are failing, venerable, huge businesses failing overnight. For a while, we had the banking institution teetering. Now it seems in at least the U.S., we have the auto industry teetering. Many small businesses have contracted or gone out of business. And as communities who have built their livelihoods around the economic base of some of these businesses experience them pulling back, community life has begun to fray in many places. And this is spreading across our country. You know, we're in a recession, and indeed many people believe it'll be a long recession. And we've managed to bring the whole world along with us. So frankly, there aren't a lot of people using the word business and flourishing in the same sentence right now. But that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about how it is that business, properly directed, can in fact be an incredible tool in God's toolkit for enabling human flourishing and advancing the kingdom of God. I suppose we ought to start for a moment or two just looking backwards and ask kind of what has business's track record been so far. And notwithstanding these horrific last few months, I think it's fair to say that we've been coming off a period of fairly sustained economic growth around the world. And there have been many positive outcomes from this. We have seen increases in health, increases in literacy, increases in the capacity to produce food. There are 400 million fewer people today living in extreme poverty than there were 20 years ago. When business has moved into areas, many times standards of living for the people affected have risen. And so really all of that you would put in the positive column in the sort of human flourishing scale. But if we're going to be fair, we also have to say that business has also been associated often with, or at least more often than it should be, human rights violations, abuse of labor, acts of environmental degradation, the cultivation of an addictive consumerism, and plays a significant role in the growing disparity between rich and poor, all of which would undermine human flourishing. And so looking backwards, it seems to me, we'd have to say at best business has a kind of a mixed score on this subject of human flourishing. Now, my discipline is business ethics. And as a result, I don't have to pay as much attention to what actually has happened in business. I get to think more about what business should do. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about how business should be pursued if it, in fact, is going to be an effective tool for advancing God's kingdom here on earth. And the first place, it seems to me, this takes us is to rethinking the central purpose, the role of business in society. Let me see if I can tee this up by sharing with you a parable that I sometimes share in some of my classes. I say to my students, imagine that you had three students come to me. The first student says to me, "Jeff, I'm thinking of going to law school. Why would God want me to be a lawyer?" And I said, "Well, that's easy. God cares about justice. If you go to law school, you can, you know, work for a just society." Second student comes to me and says, "Jeff, I'm thinking of going to medical school. Why would God want me to be a doctor?" I said, "Well, that's easy. God cares about healing, and if you're a doctor, you can work for wholeness with your patients." The third student comes to me and says, "Jeff, I'm thinking of going to business school. Why would God want me to be a business person?" And I say, "Well, that's easy, because God cares about..." And then I stop, and I invite the class to fill in the gap. If you're a professor, you know that in some classes there are always those students that throw their hands up even before you finish the question. On this one, they almost always pull their hand back down just as quickly. And the reason, I think, I've never been able to test this, is I think what their first instinct is, "God cares about money. Oh, no, this is a Christian business school. That can't be right." But it invites us into a discussion of what aspects of God's kingdom is business particularly well-suited to advance. I remember telling my dad about this. My dad is a professor of electrical engineering, a mild-mannered, kind of quiet sort of fellow. And I was telling him that our faculty were gathered around this idea of struggling to come up with a statement of purpose for business. And as I explained it, I could see him getting more and more agitated. And finally, in a very uncharacteristic way, he interrupts me. He says, "Jeff, come on. Everybody knows what the purpose of business is. The purpose of business is to make money. Or as we like to say in a more sophisticated fashion in business school, to maximize return on shareholder investment." But that is actually the dominant understanding of the role of business, the purpose of business in society. That is that a corporate manager should do all within his or her power, subject to legal and ethical constraints, to make as much money as possible and shove it upstairs to the shareholders, to the owners of the organization. That is the model that dominates most public corporations, many private corporations, and undergirds the curriculum at almost all business schools. Now, I don't know if there was ever a time when that model was adequate, but I am confident that given the enormous needs of the world today and the enormous potential of business, it is a woefully inadequate understanding of purpose. So our faculty at SPU gathered around, our business faculty gathered around this question and began to ask, and we brought in theologians and ethicists and other folks to work with us, to begin to say, could we develop from a theological or biblical basis for understanding the role of business in society? And there's a lot of ways one could get at this. We began to find it helpful to think in terms of Scripture as a grand narrative. And I know that various different theologians divide it different ways, but we began to fall into the sort of traditional creation, fall, redemption, new creation, four great movements in this grand narrative. And we began to ask, what do each of these movements have to say about the practice of business? And I wish I had more time, because I would love to walk you through all four of them. But the one that we started with and focused on initially was the creation part. Because we said, look, in these first two chapters of Genesis, we're going to get a glimpse, just a tiny little glimpse, but we're going to get a glimpse of the way God intended this place to work when he first set it up, before human beings got in there and messed it up. What was God's original design? Because we thought if we could see that, then maybe we'd have some sense as to what we would be aiming for during redemption and restoration as we work with that in the disciplines of business. So we began to draw some observations from the Genesis account. Some of these are fairly obvious, but let me give them to you fairly quickly. First thing we observed was that Adam and Eve were assigned work in the garden. You can actually go through and categorize the various things. They're to rule over the ground, or the garden, they're to till the ground, they're to name the animals. There's about five or six, seven of these things that are given to them. Sometimes we refer to them collectively as a creation mandate. But they were given work in the garden. I start with this because it still surprises me how many of my students and how many Christians that I meet in the business world somehow are carrying around with them the notion that work was assigned as a consequence of the curse. That it was because Adam and Eve disobeyed in the garden that they somehow now had to do work. There's nothing could be further from the truth. Work was embedded in God's original design for what would make us fully human. In fact, we're said, as Bishop Wright said this morning, we're said to have been made in the image of God. And theologians over the years have debated, you know, what exactly that means, how much of the glory of the Creator can be carried by the creature. But in a very sort of simple-minded way, if you're just reading Genesis from the beginning and you get to that 26th verse, you don't know very much about God at that point except this. You know, God was a worker. He was creating and making things. And after each thing he made, he said, that was good. He was making meaningful things. And so for you and I, for Adam and Eve to be made in the image of God means that at least in part, our identities are made to do creative and meaningful work. Second thing we observed was that work in the garden, as God designed it, was set in the context of relationship. Actually, that verse where we said to be made in the image of God starts with what is set out as a quote from God, where God says, let us make human beings in our image. Notice the plural, us and our. It's the first reference in Scripture to the Trinity. It reminds us that at the very beginning, before God did anything, God was in relationship. God was love before he did anything. And all of God's work comes out of that relationship, and as we saw in Colossians this morning, goes back to that relationship. And the same pattern then is replayed in human beings. God looks down in chapter 2 and says, oh, it's not so good that Adam's there by himself. I got to take care of that. And he does not make a second Adam. He makes Eve, someone with different gifts, skills, abilities, so that they can be joined together in relationship, and that out of that relationship they can do the work that they've been called to, and that that work that they've been called to can come back and nurture that relationship. And as there got to be more people, that we sometimes now speak of that, it's coming back to nurture the common good. So we thought about this from the standpoint of business, and we said, look, you know what business is particularly good at? It's not the only institution can do this, but what it is particularly good at is at creating meaningful and creative jobs in the context of relationship. I mean, business is fundamentally about bringing people together in order that they can do work. And so one fundamental starting purpose of business that we would identify from God's perspective is that business exists in society in order to provide a platform in which people can express aspects of their God-given identity through meaningful and creative work. Then we went back to Genesis and we began to look at a couple other, again, very obvious things. We observed right off the bat that Genesis tells us that the material world is good. God made a lot of things, not all material things, but he made a lot of material things. And after each one, he says, that's good. And when he finished the whole thing, he said, that's very good. And we're reminded that the material world counts to God. And this is important because when we talk about human flourishing, we don't talk just about the flourishing of the soul or the spirit or the emotions, all of which we do talk, include, but we also talk about the material well-being of God's people, of the whole world. And that's a part of what human flourishing includes. And then we observed that the garden, as God originally created it, was not complete. Now, this took me a little getting used to, because I had always grown up being told that the garden was perfect. And my picture of perfect was a static picture, like a photograph. And if Adam and Eve hadn't screwed it up, we'd all still be there in that garden, eating grapes dropped into our mouths or something. But that was what it was. I have come to see that the garden is indeed perfect, but not in a static sense, but in a dynamic sense. The garden was perfectly resourced. Everything that was necessary to unleash productivity and flourishing was embedded in the world that God made. And it was the expectation that human beings would come and unleash that productivity and cause that garden to flourish. If you look at the fifth verse of chapter 2, we're told that there were fields that were created, but as of yet they had not produced any crops. And then the writer goes on to say there's two reasons. One, God hasn't sent any rain. That makes sense. But for our purpose here, he also says, because as of yet there were no human beings to till the ground. The picture is that as God set this up, the ground was to flourish because human beings were to, and people quibble over the word, become co-creators, sub-creators. They were to work alongside God to bring forth that flourishing. In a very pragmatic sense, to bring forth that flourishing, to provide what was to be a flourishing, provide for what was to be a flourishing population. Now, God didn't have to do it that way. I mean, God could have said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to feed this growing population every day by dropping manna flakes. Did that briefly. And every morning we'll go out, stick our tongues out, and when we're satisfied, we'll go back in. But God didn't do that. What God said is, I will create people so they are capable of pooling their resources, we call that capital, so that they can design an oven, call that technological innovation, so that they can gather supplies, a supply chain, so that they can bake bread, that's operations, so they can put it on trucks, that's logistics, so they can send it out and feed a hungry world. And that's what business is for. That's one of the things that business is uniquely well-suited to do. That is, it is uniquely well-suited of the various tasks assigned to Adam and Eve to become fruitful tillers of the ground, to provide for the flourishing of the ground, for the provision for particularly the welfare of people. And so we ended up concluding that business should have two purposes from God's perspective. First, to provide a platform for people to express aspects of their God-given identity in meaningful and creative work, and second, to provide goods and services to a community that will enable it to flourish. And that's what business is for. Now, you may notice that I didn't say anything in there about profit. And when I share this sometimes, people say, Jeff, come on, aren't you the dean of a business school? I mean, don't you mean to tell me your business school doesn't care about returns on investments and profits and efficiencies? And of course we do. Of course we do. A very conventional kind of business program that we teach, except this. We never teach profit as the end of the game. Profit is the means. Profit is the means to attract the capital to the organization to let it do what it was intended to do, which is to serve. Now, if you think about it for a moment, I am suggesting that the dominant paradigm of the day should be reversed. If you think the dominant paradigm, remember, is that it's all for the shareholders. So, yes, you should most of the time be good to your employees. Why? Because it'll reduce turnover, keep your expenses down, and leave more money to send upstairs to the shareholders. You should be straight with your customers. Why? It builds brand loyalty, increases sales, more revenues to shove upstairs to the shareholders. Customers, employees become means to the end of serving the shareholders. And I'm suggesting from God's perspective we ought to think of it the other way around. We ought to think about how the capital from shareholders can serve customers and employees. Now, sometimes when I say that, people say, oh, Jeff, you're mixing this up. You're mixing up for-profits with not-for-profits. Not-for-profits are supposed to serve, and for-profits are supposed to make money. I say, look, no, you're mixing up purpose and strategy. both for-profits and not-for-profits exist to serve. They have different strategies. Not-for-profits get their money by saying, could you please give me some more? The for-profits get their money by running a revenue-generating operation that is sufficient to turn a reasonable return on capital to attract the capital in. But think of it this way. Suppose, to use it in the nonprofit world, suppose you go to a major nonprofit, let's say American Cancer Society, and you found the executive director of the American Cancer Society and you said to her, why does your organization exist? Wouldn't it strike you as a little weird if she said, we exist to raise funds? No, you'd say, no, we exist to promote research or end cancer or something. Then second question, what do you spend most of your time doing? Well, raising funds. The same is true in business. Why do you exist? We exist to serve the customers, to serve the employees. What do you spend most of your time doing? We have to pay a lot of attention to profit. We have to pay a lot of attention to the bottom line. Sometimes I get accused of not thinking profit is important. Profit is critically important, and it's extremely difficult to achieve in a highly competitive market. It takes a lot of skill, a lot of work, a lot of luck, a lot of hard effort. Profit is critically important. It is the lifeblood of a business organization. It is just not the purpose of the organization. The organization exists from God's perspective to serve. Now, when I get to this point in the talk, as I've given it in other situations, I know that there's often some pushback, some questions, actually quite a few. But for the balance of my time, I have selected three of these questions that I'm going to answer. It's kind of like question and answer, only you don't get to ask the questions. The first question sometimes is this: Jeff, does this really make any difference on the ground? Because in your model, your upside-down model, if you like, you are still saying that businesses have to make a profit. And so is it, when you really get down to business decisions, is it going to make any difference? And my answer is, yeah, it does make a difference. It doesn't make a difference in every situation, but it makes a difference over the long haul, because over the long haul, you are asking different questions and you should expect to get different answers. In the conventional model, when you're faced with business choices, the question you should be asking is, which of these choices will maximize my return on investment? Under the model that I'm suggesting, when you are faced with a business decision, your first question should be, given the assets that are under my control, given the core competencies of my organization, how can I best deploy these to enable the community to flourish? How can I best deploy these to produce products and services that will enable that community to flourish? It's a different question, and it will lead you in different directions. One of the places where I think you'll see it is in the choice of product. As the dean of business school, I have the privilege often of going out and interacting with Christians in business. And there's very many times I get back from them this kind of odd product neutrality notion. They'll say to me, in effect, Jeff, you know, it doesn't really matter if I make widgets or wadgets. It doesn't matter. What matters is, am I good to my employees? Am I fair with my vendors? Am I straight with my customers? That's really what matters. Under the model that I'm proposing, the choice of product matters a lot, because you are being invited as a business manager to ask which of the various products that I could make will most enable this flourishing to take place. I am reasonably confident that if mortgage brokers and those that funded mortgage brokers and wrote the rules for the mortgage brokers had been asking this question, if I give this person a loan that they cannot afford to repay and put them in order to put them in a house that is beyond their means, am I helping them to flourish and their community to flourish? If they had asked that question, I do not believe we would be in the mess that we are in today. So, yeah, I think the difference matters. Second question. Is this all, Jeff, your whole notion of doing business a different way, is it all about just changing the purpose? And the answer to that is no. And another big piece of it is built into this notion of sustainability. Now, if you're in and around business, you know that sustainability is a big buzzword right now. It's generally associated with environmental issues, green business, this kind of thing. I'm trying to use the word here, sustainability, in a much broader sense than that. Think back this way. In the Garden of Eden, what prevailed was shalom, Hebrew word which we often translate peace, but it's a much richer word. Peace is a very kind of thin translation. It means peace, but peace with embedded justice, with a sense of balance, with a sort of sustainable harmony. Everything is in its right place. And then at the fall, all of the shalom gets disrupted. Now, if we as Christians in business are about participating in redemption and restoration, then we are at least in part about restoring to our activities, and in this case to business, that sense of harmonious sustainability. You could develop the absolute greatest product that would really enable a community to flourish, but if the only way you can produce it is to trash the environment or trash your employees, you aren't running the kind of business that God would want you to run. The way I think of it in metaphor is as if business is this mighty river. It's racing down the hill to the sea. The sea is the destination. The sea is the purpose. You may get that right, but even so, there is so much volume in this river that you need levees along the banks in order to keep the river from overflowing the banks into the countryside and doing damage. And these levees, which we sometimes think is a lot of what business ethics is about, I think broadly could be understood under the notion of sustainability. That is, can I continue to do business this way virtually forever? Is it a sustainable model? That applies all across. It certainly applies to the environment. If I'm constantly degrading the environment, it is not sustainable. It applies to investors' capital. If I'm running the business in a way that just burns through the capital, doesn't provide a return, doesn't build a replenishment, that's not sustainable. It applies to my employees. This is why one of the reasons why I think Christians should be at the absolute front end of the livable wage movement. The reason is, in part, because if the business takes the entire earning capacity by taking those hours from an individual, but does not give back to that individual enough to live on, then that is not sustainable. That is not the way God would want that business done. So you pursue this purpose, but you do it in sustainability. I think another aspect of the crisis that we're in right now is because the business models that got us here were clearly unsustainable. They were run on this absolutely ridiculous notion that housing prices could never go down. Everyone knew, if they stopped for a few minutes to think about that, that that couldn't be true. But what they were doing was playing a massive game of musical chairs. They knew there weren't enough chairs and that there was going to be, in the words of the CEO for Citigroup, a problem when the music stops. But he says, as long as the music is still going, we need to keep dancing. That's not a sustainable model. And that's part of the reason we're in the problem we're in today. So, third question, last question. How is it, if I understand business to be functioning this way as an institution, how is it that business should be interacting with other institutions? Remember I said that there were a number of tasks given to Adam and Eve in the creation mandate, and in addition, there's a number of aspects of what we're called to do as part of reconciliation and redemption, and I'm only suggesting that business has a key role to play in certain pieces of that. There are other institutions that have key roles to play in other aspects of it. There's government, there's civil society, there's educational institutions, there's church, there's a whole array of other institutions. And what should the relationship be between institutions? Or in the context of this room, what should the interactions be between disciplines? Well, as we've thought about this question, one of the things that has been helpful to us is to think through Pauline writings on the subject of principalities and powers. This is a phrase or words to that effect that show up about a dozen times in the Pauline epistles. And if I understand this correctly, for many, many years, biblical scholars would sort of just skim right over those words, thinking that more or less they were talking about angels or something. But in the last century, as I understand it, there's been increasing scholarly focus on those words, and the growing impression is that they are not just references to heavenly beings, that in fact, in context, they are better understood as references to institutions, structures, orders, worldviews, various things that have power and authority in shaping our lives here on earth. Now, if that's true, then business, free market capitalism, all of this is a part of the principalities and the powers. What does Paul tell us about them? Well, we read it in Colossians this morning. He tells us that in the beginning, these were created by God, and they were created for good. They were created, I think, to, in a sense, create space for human flourishing. The picture I have in mind is of these institutions as giant pillars holding up the roof to create space where humanity can flourish. That was God's original intent. At the fall, human beings were unwilling to be creatures subject to God. They wanted to be gods themselves. And Paul tells us the same thing happens of principalities and powers. The principalities and powers want to be God rather than playing supportive roles, demand to be worshipped, and want sole authority. Now, that creates a lot of problems, but one of them is it changes the dynamic between institutions. It creates an arrogance and an adversarial nature in what used to be a cooperative endeavor of holding up the roof. And so as business looks out at other institutions, frankly, it often does so arrogantly and with a sense that they are the enemy. The arrogance showed up again in this current crisis. There was a period of time when regulators were coming forth suggesting that credit default swaps should be regulated. In retrospect, not a bad idea. But at the time, the business community rushed in and said, no, you don't understand. These are very, very complicated things. Really, only really, really, really smart people like us in business know what we're doing with these. You government don't have any business here. And on a hugely bipartisan basis, the government bought that. Another example recently, Archbishop Rowan Williams was speaking, and he gave what I thought was a fairly benign talk in which he said, really, I think nothing more than that sometimes free trade does not instantly benefit everybody on both sides of the arrangement. And shocking, but the economist, the arbiter of business and free trade, took him to task and suggested in very direct terms that the church should stay out of things that it does not really know about and leave those things to business. The church should go over and do salvation and things like that. So business can be fairly arrogant, and it can tend to view other institutions in a adversarial mode. That is, I am seeing them as the enemy. There is a knee-jerk reaction among most business people to any form of government regulation because government is against us. And same is true as they relate often to the civil society, and same is true as they relate to family and other institutions. But it works both ways. Other institutions bring that same level of arrogance and adversarial interactions to business. I can tell you that as the dean of a business school in a small Christian private university, you often feel a little bit like the weird cousin, the one everybody knows they have but aren't so happy to see at Thanksgiving. There is a sense that you kind of don't quite fit. And many other institutions often look at business as if it were the enemy. Has to be controlled. Civil society, instantaneously, business is evil. One of the worst offenders of this is the church. I meet with many people in business who have felt disenfranchised by the church. The church speaks to business people and sends a signal that sort of goes something like this: we love you because Jesus loves everybody. And we're glad you're in our church because you're really helping with the building fund. We're not so sure we know what to do with and don't really like to talk about what you do because it's, you know, all that greed stuff. And they don't know what to do with that. They feel disenfranchised by their church. They feel cut off. They feel like the church has sent the signal to them that their institution doesn't count. That's wrong. It's wrong on both sides of the equation. We need, as Christians, to begin to once again recapture that vision that we are all in different institutions collectively pursuing the common good, collectively holding up the same roof. We need to encourage one another. We need to look for ways to buttress one another. We need to look for ways to support one another. This is what I think means to be business, another way of doing business. It means the business should be to serve. It needs to be done in a way that sustains. And as it relates to other institutions, it needs to support. Now, you know, however you feel about this, I believe this to be a true statement. That is, over the next 50 years, I'm going to say it will be at least be one of the dominant institutions to change the face of our world will be business. That is, business is going to shape what the world we live in, whether you like it or not. It just has too much of the world's wealth under its control. Its assets are just, its reach is just too transnational now. It's just beyond anybody else's control. So good or bad, business is going to shape the world that we live in. But it could be for good. I mean, this is such an incredibly wonderful time for Christians to be called into the discipline of business. Because if we can reorient business towards service, if we can insist that it do it in a way that is sustainable, and if we can encourage it to work with other institutions cooperatively, we can change the world for good. We can enable human flourishing. We can advance God's kingdom. I just close with a verse from Matthew 9, paraphrase. He looks out and he says, "The harvest is plentiful." I translate that, "The potential is plentiful." I pray that God will send Christians into this field. Thank you very much.